Live update on status of implementing the Scott River TMDL waiver, Brian McFadden.
Good afternoon, Chairman Corbett and members of the board. Brian McFadden, of your staff, here to present to you an update on progress made in implementing the Scott River TMDL waiver. here's an outline of the ground I intend to cover in this presentation, starting with the fact sheet that this board requested upon the adoption of the waiver. I also want to talk about how we've prepared for the assessments that are a major component of the waiver, as well as doing those assessments and some of the other activities that we've been involved with related to the the waiver and the TMDL. So at the time the waiver was adopted, this board requested that staff develop a fact sheet that explains the contents of the waiver in plain language. And we've done so. It's been on the TMDL, the Scott TMDL webpage for quite some time. And it was a fact sheet that the Shasta team and I worked together with to make sure that we had consistency between those two fact sheets as it is appropriate, but with reflecting the difference in the Scott TMDL waiver. And it's turned out to be a very useful piece of information. It's been helpful in explaining what I'm trying to do to people who I'm trying to access their property. It has come into play in that way, in a way that's been very helpful. So moving on to preparing for the assessments, we've been we've taken a number of steps to sort of build the capacity of this program and get the momentum going, starting with the development and ongoing maintenance of a tracking database so that we can track progress in completing water quality assessments and track the follow-up actions that that arise from those assessments and any correspondence that that occurs, with the idea and hope that you know, were I to win the lottery or, God forbid, you know, have an accident on the way up to Scott Valley, somebody else could pick this up and know right where to continue on. another component of gearing up for this waiver implementation has been the development of a contract with the Siskiyou RCD for ranch water quality planning assistance. This is a companion piece where, as you might recall, through the water quality assessment process, when issues are discovered, we request a plan to address the issue and correct it. And ranch water quality planning is one avenue that a landowner would have to do that. It's not a requirement that they go through that process, but the idea is that we're providing an avenue for assistance for landowners who wish to go that route. and so that's involved the development of the contract as well as some management, but also the tailoring of a ranch water quality template for conditions in Scott Valley. That template originally started as a template that the Marin RCD had developed as part of implementing the Tamales Bay TMDL, and it was later adapted for the Shasta TMDL process, and then we've taken it and adapted it for the Scott, and I think, you know, ultimately, this is going to be sort of a living template that continues to be honed and revised as we come across situations that we hadn't before. I also set up a training event, which was a training for both for regional board staff and for Siskiyou RCD staff. One of my goals is to involve other staff from this agency. The TMDL work plan that my work falls under allots about a quarter of my time to implementing this waiver. And so one of my goals is to enlist my colleagues here who are already making the long journey up to Scott Valley and Siskiyou County and working on non-point source issues, enlist them in the process and increase our capacity to get these water quality assessments completed. So we did have some participation from timber staff in that training, and the focus of that training was identifying water quality issues that come up in the water quality assessments and the appropriate mitigation response to those sorts of issues, as well as for the RCD staff, implementing the ranch water quality planning process, and going over the template, and that actually resulted in some changes to the template. It was a good discussion. We've built our capacity in that way. As far as the water quality assessments themselves, of course, the process begins by contacting a landowner, so far I haven't been turned down, I would again point out that the fact sheet has been really helpful with that. My approach is typically to call or speak directly to a landowner, explain the process. There's been some reticence, so I have just offered that I'll send the landowner the fact sheet and the waiver and allow them to look that over, and then I've called them back, and that's been an approach that's worked well because, there a lot of the questions that they have are answered through the fact sheet, and then they can ask me additional questions that come up after reading through that information. So once we have the go-ahead and have the assessment scheduled, then the next step is to do some aerial photo analysis and identify the property boundaries and the features of interest, primarily the stream reaches and any wetland features, those sorts of things that are on the landscape. And then the next step is to get on the ground with the landowner and go over those features, visit those features, walk the stream course, inspect the wetlands, and ultimately determine if those management practices and infrastructure that are in place are adequate to control sediment discharges and maintain or restore riparian vegetation. Another piece of information that I've developed comes straight out of the waiver itself. It's a checklist. This is a great tool to walk through the assessment, but also prompt discussion with the landowner. And the way I've used this is where things are an issue and have come up, I can check the box, write out a description of the issue, and leave this with the landowner so that they can, have that and mull it over. So that's been helpful. The assessment is basically going through that checklist and evaluating how the practices measure up. So progress to date, we have 9 landowners that are currently participating in the program, and that covers about 14 miles of stream frontage. So far, only 5 water quality assessments have been completed, which amounts to 4.5 miles. We've got two landowners who are going directly to the ranch planning process, and I'll do the water quality assessment following the development of their ranch plan. And I'm going to be going up next week to, you know, do some more. You might notice there's a bit of discrepancy between the 14 and a half miles and or 14 miles and 4.5 miles. And that's because some of the largest landowners are going straight to the ranch water quality planning process. And so they're in the program, but we just haven't done that assessment. Additionally, you might recall that the priority for this waiver was the 15 largest landowners, which manage about half the stream length in Scott Valley adjacent to management. And to date, three of those 15 are engaged in the program. So the other six, you might be wondering, well, why did you get out of priority? And it's really about piloting the process and working through it on properties that I can you know, have some trust. I know what the situation is, and with the idea that it's a small town, word gets around fast. Before I start contacting landowners in mass, it's good for the reputation of the program to be out there, and so that explains why, you know, it hasn't been all just those 15 largest landowners. In addition, we've initiated requests of the large timber landowners that they develop erosion control plans to cover erosion sources not typically addressed through the timber harvest planning process, and and that's moving forward. And then in regards to other TMDL-related activities, you may recall that a big component of the Scott River TMDL has to do with understanding the interaction of groundwater and surface waters as it relates to temperature specifically. There's been quite a bit of effort that I've been involved with in managing the contract that UC Davis has in developing this. And you might also recall about a year ago, Dr. Harder from UC Davis came and presented to this board the work that he'd been doing. Since that time, he's completed, he and his team have completed this report and also a paper in Water Resources Research, which provides some great peer review and validation of the process there. And so that involved some review and comment on my part. Additionally, I've been involved with the Groundwater Advisory Committee. They're very active in Scott Valley and are very keen on tackling these issues. I've been quite impressed with the energy that group has and their willingness to and desire to address the flow issues that are present in Scott Valley. Another element of our work that supports that effort has to do with a 319H grant for the collection of data that goes into the model that Dr. Harder's been developing, and we've been out to inspect some of the sites where they've been collecting data, and that data includes flow measurements, but it also includes some really sophisticated measurements of soil moisture, evaporation, and a number of other meteorological parameters so that they can validate how much water people are using to irrigate their field and also understand some complexities that have come up in regards to what's assumed about alfalfa evapotranspiration and what the data is showing and what the landowners are reporting their, you know, in terms of their water use. So that's been a very important piece of this effort, and one that's supported through our 319H program. And then the Division of Water Rights has gotten very interested in this project, in the study. And I've spent some time with Division of Water Rights staff, helping them get up to speed with the situation on the ground, and as well as the players and that sort of thing. Also, we have a 319H grant that we've been administering for repair and restoration. The photo there is one of the sites where the RCD has been planting riparian species on the floodplain, and there's quite a number of trees that have been planted there. I don't have the total for you, but it's many acres. Also, the Moffett Creek Fencing Project, which started a few years ago, has finally come to completion, and there's been some work on the part of your staff to see that through. I do want to mention that this isn't meant to be a comprehensive listing of all the things that are going on in the watershed that relate to the TMDL. The RCD and the Watershed Council have been very active in a number of projects that aren't represented here. The Department of Fish and Wildlife and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service both have projects that they've been funding in the valley. And so I'm really showing you here what your staff has been directly involved with. And that would also include implementation of the Forest Service waiver and the timber program, our dairy permits, and the rest of the sort of core regulatory activities that we do. As far as our next steps, continue those water quality assessments. That's a big priority, but and then following up with the actions that are identified in those assessments, of course. We'll spend quite a bit of time, I think, with the landowners working out the details of those erosion control plans. And then, of course, we'll continue to keep you and the public informed on how we're doing and how it's going. And with that, I just want to present one last piece of information. This is some information that I had received, I believe it was last week, and this is the COHO numbers for going back to 2007. You'll see that this year's number has an asterisk by it, and that's because at the time they were still counting. There's still more fish coming, and it's pretty significant. That's a large number of coho when you look at how it relates to the rest of the state. There was a comment earlier that the Eel River has the largest run of coho, and I believe that is erroneous. This is a big run of coho, and what's probably more important is that if you look at the different brood years, we're seeing increasing numbers. The numbers are going in the right direction. You can also see that there's one strong brood year and two weaker brood years, and that, of course, is something that puts the whole population in jeopardy. But the direction is in the right direction. Of course, we've got big numbers of coho this year and no rain, so it represents both good news and a significant challenge as the community and agencies try to figure out how to keep the progeny of this year's large run alive and successful. But I just wanted to present that because I think it's significant information. And that's my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Board Member Gusti, do you have?
This particular graft, I mean, it gets back to the discussion we had earlier on the three-year life cycle of coho, and you know, it's perfect. Every 3 years you see a different cohort, and so next year looks like it's going to be a real bad run because of what happened 2 years ago. This is the kind of data that people need to see. I mean, it's great, and also the data of how many people are accepting a plan, implementing a plan, and then doing follow-up monitoring. I mean, that's how we'll cast a net to get more people involved. If people can appreciate that, gee, it's not that much work, or maybe there's some cost share monies out there, and we can be able to show these kinds of improvements, you know, that's the best incentive out there. So good work, Brian. Thanks. Thanks for your efforts.
I can't take credit for all that, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, let me say also thank you, Brian. This is good stuff. We were, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, I remember in July in Fort Jones getting yelled at and told to go home and so forth. This is a pretty good turnaround from that stuff. Have you got an idea, because you get to see it, but do we have an idea yet of what the water flow is going to be for Scott this year? Because that really could upset the apple cart in everybody's world.
I think the consensus is it's going to dry up unless we get some real rain and probably snowpack on the hills. It's really disturbing right now to go into Scott Valley and look up on those hills and not see much snow, because that's really the water bank, and it's just not there. The Division of Water Rights has issued curtailment letters. Yes. They sent out 190 of those letters. Mm-hmm. Board Member Moore mentioned that. This is going to be a tough year in the Scott for not only for fish but for farmers. It's not a good situation.
What kind of a sense do you have? Is it a dog eat dog, or is there a community feeling that we'll make it one way or another?
You know, I was unable to attend the last Groundwater Advisory Committee meeting, which was just this Monday, but I did read a summary of the meeting that Kevin Porzio from the Division of Water Rights provided, and there was talk of as extreme a measure as just simply not irrigating, not pumping, until the river dries up, because they don't want it, they're fearful of getting the blame for drying up the river in a year that they know it's going to dry up. The county has been actively trying to develop a drought response. I know that to be the case, and the community, outside of the advisory committee, is also looking at what things can be done to address the drought situation, and I'm thinking of the Watershed Council particularly there. But there's not a lot that can be done to keep water in the river. As I said, there's not a lot of snow on the hill. I think it's about managing the catastrophe if it comes to pass that way. I know the Department of Fish and Wildlife has a long record of fish rescue, where they gather up fish that are stranded and place them in a location that's wet and cold. But, you know, those places are going to be hard to come by, you know, this year. But it's going to take a lot of coordination and a lot of thinking and a lot of efforts on a lot of people's part. To make sure that in 3 years that number is even higher.
Is there anything that you have seen that we can assist with? Scott is kind of a poster child, as you know. I mean, we've had it's kind of one where we have a TMDL, et cetera. So
well, one of the things I've been hearing is sort of complaints that the groundwater study is taking as long as it has. I know that the community there and members of the Groundwater Advisory Committee in particular are really anxious to have that tool in place so that they can evaluate different strategies. Unfortunately, this drought year is coming before that model is ready to use as a tool that way. But they've been thinking about this for a while now, and that's the direction they're headed, is trying to find the solutions that work. A lot of the things that have been talked about are surcharging the aquifer with surface water during the snowmelt when there's plenty of water in the river, to try and get the water table higher going into the summer. Of course, that's not an option really this year. Another thing that's been discussed is moving production wells further away from the river, or relying on wells that are already away from the river, and working out agreements with among landowners and neighbors to share wells that way. Those things have been discussed, but I wouldn't expect to see that right away.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Board Member Norton.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Brian. Thanks for coming back and talking to us about this. Let me ask you just about, I would imagine, I was going to ask you about prioritization, but I imagine that's just pretty much plain right on your face. You know, you keep going with what you're doing now to get to the 15 landowners that were prioritized to begin with. It looks like you're having success out here. By the way, I'll acknowledge that this is a tough watershed to work in. Having gone up there and got yelled at a couple times myself, it is a tough watershed. And I commend you, by the way, for building on inertia here and working towards goals. I think the fact sheet was a good idea, and it sounds like it's paying some dividends out there. And I want to just say thank you for going out there and doing that. At the same time, let me ask you, because I remember, you know, Dr. Harder coming here, and I've seen his presentation a couple times now, including in the Valley. How far off is that thing from being able to really be used in a tool? It seems like this would be the greatest year to drag that thing out and really just see what's going on out there. And
right.
Use it as the tool that it's really meant to be. Can you speculate to that? How far?
Yeah. So the issue is calibration. And getting the model tuned into the observations that are available, which is part of the reason why we've invested in having those observations through the 319H grant, and previous to that, just our contract funds. But it's one of those things. Model calibration is one of those things where you do some calibration, you button up one bit of the model, and you find out that one thing or another is more influential than another, and so then that directs you to go seek better information in that realm or better characterize that process. And so going into the calibration, you can never really say how long it's going to take, and it's taken longer than Dr. Harder and Dr. Foley have estimated. The latest estimate is the beginning of summer for getting that calibration done. And I had been up in the watershed in December when the team had come up to present their latest results and discuss the calibration issues. And they've made significant progress in identifying the things that they need to focus on, and have a clear direction that they're going to go in to address those things. But that work just simply needs to get done. I have to acknowledge that one of the factors in it is that Dr. Harder has taken a sabbatical and has been working from afar. And directing his team in the process. He's due back in next month, and I expect that that'll increase the momentum on that project.
Can I also ask you about data and trend monitoring out here? Because I think that data and trend monitoring is a very important tool to assess what's happening and where our effectiveness is here. I shouldn't say our, where the effectiveness of this implementation possibly can be seen and evaluated and possibly show holes. Can I ask you to just share, you know, what is the state of data and trend monitoring here?
Well, I can briefly summarize. The focus lately has been primarily on flows and temperature, because that's, you know, everyone's biggest concern. And I think everyone recognizes that the biggest issue affecting beneficial uses are the flows. And so that's where a lot of the effort's been put. Our city has been continuing to do some of the other monitoring it does. The V-Star monitoring in French Creek has been ongoing. But they've also expanded that out to some of the other streams. But those activities are dependent on them getting funding to do that. And they're not the types of, you know, with sediment monitoring in particular, it's not the kind of thing that that you do every year necessarily in a location if things aren't changing, you know. So the compliance and trend monitoring plan that we have recommends a 5-year return interval on some of the monitoring, and even a 10-year on some of the other ones. Our percent fines comes to mind, you know, with the McNeil sampling. And so some of those things just haven't come up. But sure.
Can I also ask you, I rather enjoyed, and I'll tell Rebecca, I rather enjoyed the TMDL report cards and the EO report. Is there such a report card for the Scott that's to be found?
There isn't, no.
The very last thing I'd like to ask is you come back and see us in a year, because I think that these, and I know I've done that to you guys a lot, but I think it's important. I think it's really important for us to hear what's going on. I think it's also important to have a frank discussion about where we need to go and identify some of the priorities. And I do want to thank you for your work and other staff involved in this project. So I'm going to keep you coming back.
That's part of the next steps I identified.
Thanks, Matt.
Board Member Hale.
Thanks. Brian, real quick, the model's not calibrated yet, but you showed a nice slide of a final report cover, and we've got a publication of Water Resources Research. So is that just describing the methodology for the model, or are these two different things?
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. That report and this paper discusses the approach of keeping track of the water balance. So there's a fairly sophisticated approach that has been implemented there, where in addition to the groundwater model, which tracks saturated aquifer conditions, there's a soil water budget model that couples with that and tracks the evapotranspiration, the amount of irrigation, the soil water content, and the amount of water that then passes through to that, you know, into deep percolation to the aquifer. And it's quite an exercise in assembling a whole lot of information on crops, water use for individual crops, the rotation of irrigation, and a whole host of factors. And that report and this paper discuss how that was done and presents that.
I just wanted to comment. I remember when we first went up there, they were denying that coho were there or ever had been there, and this chart
shows.
There
are still people who will deny that.
Right,
yeah.
I know, but I think this chart shows some progress, that people are counting the things that aren't there anymore. So that's positive.
Yeah, it is fish and wildlife data.
Yeah. I am unclear, but I hope the 319H funds continue to fund the work of Dr. Harder, because I do think that's an important piece of work. And
yeah. So there's a 319H grant that funds the RCD to collect data, but then there's also another contract that we have, which isn't. It's not a grant. It's actual contract dollars that are discretionary contract dollars that have been paying him, and we're continuing to go down that road. We've applied for those funds and are optimistic that we'll get the green light on that for the next phase.
Then when Dr. Harder appeared here, and maybe I misunderstood, but I thought the overall summary you got is the model, the basic model is done, it's working, and then the calibration would take considerable amounts of time, that probably every year you'd try and recalibrate another portion of it, and at some point you want it to go live before.
Yeah.
10 more years of academic study. And what's your sense on that?
Well, there have been different phases of the model. So there was version one of the model that had been developed that did not include this more sophisticated water budgeting and tracking approach. So that's sort of the version two of the model. You know, version one was a bit more coarse model. It's very similar to the Karuk model that you may be aware of. Version two is a much more sophisticated approach and with better resolution in terms of the results, you know, the outputs, I should say. And so I think I'm hearing a little frustration maybe from you also that it's taking a while. And, you know, I share in that frustration. we're moving forward. And I do expect that that we'll have a working model this year that they can begin to run scenarios. I should say the Groundwater Advisory Committee has about 20 scenarios that they've already identified that they want to run. There's a lot of pressure coming from all sides to get this model done.
I bet there. And then I'm glad you brought up the Karuk model. My understanding is it's not going to ever be calibrated down for in management, but it's looking at the entire watershed. And so some people use it sort of to check the harder model because the two, they may seem real different, but at a certain macro level, they need to coincide. And what's your impression on that?
The Karuk model is very similar to the version one model. They incorporate the same modeling package, ModFlow, which is a USGS model, and many of the same assumptions. There was some data sharing between Dr. Harder and SS Papadopoulos, who's the contractor involved in developing the Karuk model. And so on the gross scale, yeah, the results should be similar, and they have been. But it's gross scale results.
Okay. I think those are my questions. Thank you for your report, and I want us to just keep on it in that watershed.
Thank you very much.
So I will now call up members of the public and Felice Pace from the Klamath Forest Alliance. See, I'm learning Felice.
Thank you, Chad. thank you. Felice Pace, Klamath Forest Alliance, and Water Chair for the North Group of the Sierra Club for this presentation. Also, I moved to Scott Valley in 1976. I still own a home there. Me and the Bank of America do. And I've lived mostly on the coast the last 10 years, but I spent a lot of time up in the watershed. The first waiver was adopted August 9th, 2006. That's 7 years and 6 months ago. You may remember, those of you that were here, that we had a plan for voluntary compliance, but on October 4th, 2012, David Leland came back and said voluntary compliance wasn't working, that now we were going to regulate, and we got a new waiver on that date. The explanation, the first waiver was to implement voluntary compliance through the Siskiyou RCD. We were told that failed. Now the RCD is back as the main implementer of the, as far as the presentation went. What we heard today is not a report on regulatory action. Staff on its own authority has chosen to continue the voluntary approach, including relying on this Siskiyou RCD. There's been no notification of who is subject to regulation. There's been no enrollment. There are no hard requirements for riparian protection to allow for natural recovery. And you know, so far, the program has dealt in those 6.5 years with five completed plans, an average of, I think, 1.4 plans per year, if I did my math right. Well, there's one that the nine landowners that are participating, that's 1.4 per year. If you look at the number of years we've had that waiver, it's less than one per year for the five that have been completed during the period of this. We do have a Scott River Water Quality Compliance and Trend Monitoring Plan. It's a very good plan. It's on your website. Unfortunately, it's not being implemented. Even though under the Forest Service waiver, a lot of the data is there on water quality and its sediment, including data on the Scott. And here's a table in that plan of all the watersheds. There's three pages of watersheds where we have water quality, ongoing, you know, water quality data. Why isn't this being compared with what we have today? Why are, you know, this is a water quality agency. It's not a fish agency, but we're showed a slide with fish. And I want to make a point. Here's all the, you know, this is from that plan. It's all the places where we collect temperature. But yet we're not doing them to give this board, we're not doing any data analysis to give this board a sense and the public a sense of what is actually, if anything, is actually being accomplished. There's shade. A lot of this riparian extent monitoring that's defined in here can be done remotely just by looking at aerial photographs and comparing them. Are we making progress or aren't we? We're asking voluntarily for erosion control plans. Why aren't we implementing WDRs like we have with Green Diamond, with some hard requirements for that kind of monitoring? Why is only Green Diamond the only person that's being required, the only timber company that's being required? You know, there's that. This is a Chris Klamath chart page from the Chris Klamath system that shows temperatures over a range of years. This kind of data could have been presented today. It's what was asked for, and this, you know, but we're not seeing it. You know, we need to know whether this approach is working or not. Is it improving water quality after 7.5 years, or what did I, 6.5? Okay. I have a couple of recommendations. I guess I'm done with this particular presentation. I would, you know, like to see in a year or so if some actual data that the board can look at to see if the approach is working or not. Oh, actually, I was going to tell you, you know, I have a lot of it's complaint-driven. It says right in there, you know, that we're going to look at complaints. Well, I complained initially about three sites. I've reiterated those complaints, one on Soap Creek, one on Johnson Creek, one on Moffett Creek, that were feedlots right on the creek, totally devegetated, where the animals were being fed right on live streams. Those complaints are now over 6 years old. And you can go out there right now, and there is no fencing, there's no riparian exclusion, there's no recovery of the vegetation on any of those sites. What has happened is the animals were removed temporarily and then brought back at a later time. You know, fences were promised. I was told by staff, I could show you emails that, oh, yeah, there's an electric fence, and it's going to become, it never was an electric fence. It was a pretend electric fence. And there's going to be, things are going to happen, but things haven't happened. So I just want to make one final point about this number. It's great that 2,657 fish arrived there. We know that that's mostly ocean conditions. We had a big run because we've had outstanding ocean conditions. But most of those fish were counted in the Scott River Canyon below Scott Valley. Because of the combination of low flow conditions and the fact that pumping continues unabated after October 1st and October 15th when surface irrigation ends, and irrigation through pumping just continues because it's unregulated, those fish could not make it to their spawning grounds. And this spring, the progeny of any of them that did make it to spawn, because they mostly spawned right over other reds in the main river, are going to have a heck of a hard time. So we got a good year of run. We're going to lose the production. And that could put us into the category where those other two cohorts are, which is below survival rate, genetic survival rate.
I've let you go about three times.
I know
time.
You did, John, and I appreciate it.
But the other thing is you raise a lot of complex issues, and I'm not critical at all. I didn't see a letter from you. If you did, somehow it didn't get through to me. I think when you have this many issues and this much complexity, a letter to the board would be really helpful so we can read it and chew on it.
Yeah, I'll do that. I just got back from being overseas for on Saturday, so I didn't have time to do that. I had to make a presentation to the board on grazing to the Forest Service. So, but I will follow up with you. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate that. Anyone else from the public? Does staff want to make any comments in response or not? And then when we're done with this, I'm going to turn the chair over to Board Member Norn for the Shasta so I can go inquire as to the status of the order that we're asking being typed up.
I can give you an update on that.
You want a break? Yeah. I think we have a board lobby for a break. So maybe we'll finish this up and we'll take a break and
sure.
We can accomplish all our purposes.
So just in regards to a few of those comments, Mr. Pace, you know, averaged over a six-year period the number of assessments and people involved with the program. That program started a year ago, October. So I don't think a six-year denominator is the right way to go there. Also, he characterized that we stuck the RCD with implementing the TMDL, and that's just not an accurate portrayal. And to date, and still, they are a partner in the implementation of the TMDL, but it's our responsibility, and we haven't put it on them to go and implement the TMDL, and I just want to correct that. In regards to monitoring and all the information, Mr. Pace did request that information be presented, but I did not hear that request from either management or board, and I think you'll see in the next presentation that summarizing that information, gathering it up, and making sense is not a trivial matter. It takes a lot of effort, and we can do that. And I hope that following the Shasta report that you're about to hear about, that we take that effort and move it into the SCOT. But it's not just a matter of gathering up some numbers and putting it in a PowerPoint presentation. I just want to point out that it's a significant effort.
Brian, do you have a staff of 50 or more now?
Myself? For this program?
Looks like you.
It's just partial me, in fact. I've been getting help from others, and I appreciate all that. But we could.
I absolutely agree with Mr. Pace. I wish we could get more information. I wish we could do a whole lot of things really quickly. In fact, sitting next to him is Mr. Myers, who has also said that. But we're still. We heard some nice numbers this morning from Mr. Moore about. How many have been added to the state staff, but I'm not hearing them give them to the regional staff, so I think we're stuck with what we have. I don't think we're going to get that. I absolutely agree with you, Felice. I wish we could get faster, but there's only one of him, and it's just a problem, and it's a problem in every area we have.
Okay, any other board comments, questions? I had one. Where those fish were counted is pretty important for interpreting the data, and so I would be interested in next time on the chart we have the counting station or area.
Sure, I can tell you. Because
if it is in the canyon, there's serious issues whether it can make it up. And
it's not terribly far downstream of Scott Valley. It's near a place called Jones Beach, which I want to say is 6 miles below the valley. It's outside of the valley. It's not yet to the place where the gradient really picks up and some of the
I think where it's being counted is important information for interpreting the data.
Sure. Okay.
And thank you for your report.